But tonight, look at this. We truly have come to the end of those things future, because now we're looking at the eternal state. And so we tend to think of prophetic events, and a lot of times we don't include this. But certainly it's at the end of those things. In fact, sort of brings to bear a scripture that maybe we often don't think of in this respect, but it really is very very apropos, very applicable to where we are. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, beginning to read in verse number 24. Of course, right before this, in verse 23, he talks about the resurrection. But every man in his own order, and he tells us what that is. Christ the first fruits, that's already happened. Afterward, they that are Christ at his coming, so we look forward to that. And then he says, then cometh the end when he, that is Jesus, shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. For he must reign. So there's the 1,000 years. We've seen the resurrection, the 1,000 years. He must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. For he that put all things under his feet, but when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, that is excluded, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subjected unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. So there's one you don't often think of in this respect, but that kind of touches base with it right there. And this is where we are now. We're at the end of time, as you and I think of it. Oftentimes when we think of that phrase, the end of time, that has kind of a scary connotation to us. But it shouldn't really for us as Bible-believing Christians, but it really does make an interesting question or thought come to mind, and that is how I've titled tonight's message, What Will It Be Like in Eternity? Did you ever think about that? And of course, I'm sure we have. I'm sure that thought has passed through our minds. But what I think happens, and it's no fault of ours, it's kind of, in a lot of ways, all we know, we tend to think about that maybe in human concepts and in human ways of thinking. And so we think to ourselves, wow, eternity's a long time to strum one's harp. It reminds me one time we had someone who was helping and kind of looking over some of the expenditures. And the office supplies category, I remember at that point, was $6,000. And the person made the remark, boy, $6,000 is a lot of money for paper clips. And I smiled, but one part of me winced because I thought, you know, that kind of betrays a lack of real insight into what really is goes on in the office and what's really in that budget category. And I think that's sometimes how we approach these things, that we don't really think a lot about it, and when we make a comment about like the 1,000 or eternity is a long time to be strumming one's harp or playing one's violin, it really just kind of betrays that we haven't thought very much about this from a biblical perspective. Because while there may not be all the information we'd like, there certainly is some. And so that's what we're going to spend our time with tonight. Once again, we'll do survey, then significance. I like to bring before you 4 observations in an attempt to give some answer to the question, what will it be like in eternity? Now, could I say something to you just briefly, a little word further by way of introduction? In this passage, it's only fair to say, Revelation 21:1, covering that whole chapter, going down through verse 5 of the next chapter, that some people would say, well, in verses 1 through 8, which are the verses that I chose to read, that's the part of this that deals with eternity, and the other part deals with the millennium. I've just titled it for us tonight, The Eternal State. Is that a problem? The fact that you have some interpreters, good ones, who think that it's only verses 1 through 8 that really deal with eternity and the rest deals with the millennium. And I don't really think so. I don't think it's anything worth getting up in arms about. And I'll tell you the reason I say that. It's not because I just want to defend my view, because I'm not really worried about that. I think I've already mentioned to you that when you start dealing with these subjects, anybody who thinks he has a full handle on it all is just crazy. But I don't think it's worth really the argument. And the reason I say that is because once you realize that the New Jerusalem is both a part of the millennium and eternity, and once you realize that the glorified people who inhabit the New Jerusalem during the millennium, glorified saints, people who have been raised and who help and share in the administration and reign during the millennium, once you realize that for those people eternity has already begun, Well, then it really wouldn't surprise us that there might be some overlapping thoughts between those two ideas. So to me, it's not really worth splitting hairs over. But to our survey, in verses 1 through 8, we talk about what we might call the new order. Now, you notice I didn't call it the new world order. I've been sort of turned off to that phrase ever since the first Bush mentioned it. Because, I don't know, I just don't like that one world thinking that seems to go along with that. But one thing I can sure tell you is it says in verse number 1 that the former things have passed away. He says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And isn't that an interesting comment, and there was no more sea? Now, if you grew up along the sea like I did, you might pause on that and think, oh, that's a bummer. What, are they going to have mountains and no sea? So all the people in Pennsylvania says, whoopee, we have mountains. And the people that grew up along the coast are thinking, bummer, no sea. And I don't really know that I have the full answer for you on that, other than I was very intrigued when I was in college on one occasion. I believe I was college rather than graduate, but I don't really remember. Must have been college, because I remember where I was. And that building wasn't used when I was in graduate school for Sunday services. But at any rate, I remember sitting there, and Bob Jones Jr. came out to preach, and he preached on that very text, right in that verse, and there was no more sea. What an intriguing text to preach on. And he developed it, of course, with any number of thoughts, but the overriding idea in it is that in the Scripture, many of the connotations of the sea are negative. And you can certainly find verses that that go to that direction. And so the point is that everything about the new order, the new heavens and the new earth, there is no more of any of the negativity associated with the world as we know it today. And that was the point of his sermon. And maybe that's the whole point of what's here. But at any rate, we also look at verse 4. And at the end of verse number 4, notice this, for the former things are passed away. So it's all gone. All those things that we are accustomed to here, not so much the good, but the things that we associate with the fallen nature of the world as we know it now, the negative things. And then we have the wonderful statement in verse number 5 that God says, behold, I make all things new. Don't you love something when it's new? Have you ever met a kitten that wasn't cute? Have you ever met a puppy you didn't want? Have you ever met a little kid that you didn't think was cute in some way? Very seldom that happens, right? Have you ever seen a building when it's been freshly painted that it didn't really say, wow, that looks nice? Did you ever see a new car you didn't like? Well, maybe some. Fords, maybe, but no. But boy, there is just something, and I think it's funny, some people came in here and said, I smell new paint. I said, yeah, people pay money for that smell. Of course, we did, but then we also realized that you can get those things for your car, you know, that smell like a new car, even when it's not a new car anymore. Because there's something about when something is fresh and new. But you just think of any of those sensations that you can identify with in this life and magnify that beyond anything you can really comprehend, when what is the point is that nothing that we would associate with the difficult, fallen nature of this world is any longer a part of eternity. It's gone. Now, we find a verse in the book of 2 Peter that gives more descriptive terms to this, so I only mention it for the sake of interest. You can't be complete, but I'll do this one. 2 Peter 3:10, it says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So the former things pass away. I like that verse because it sort of gives you some pause for thought about some of the scientific things that we now know and understand about the created order, where it talks about all that heat and the energy and those types of things that we know a little bit more about now. Albeit keeping consistent with the fact that almost exclusively in the Bible, fire is an image of judgment. And so it holds true there as well. Now, survey-wise, what comes next? Well, of course, the New Jerusalem. And again, here's where now I want to kind of, I'm sure I'll frustrate some people by not talking about the very thing that maybe you would be interested in, but let's look down. We'll come back and do a little bit more with some statements that are made in verses 1 through 8, but for right now, we're picking it up with verse number 9. And the first thought about the New Jerusalem is identity. So notice in verses 9 through 10, he says, "There came unto me one of the seven angels which had the seven bowls or vials full of the seven last plagues, and talked with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain." Interesting, great and high mountain, because it was from that perspective in Ezekiel 40 through 48 that Ezekiel was taken to see the things that he saw. And there's a parallelism with that. Anyway, it continues, that great city he showed me, the Holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Well, the only point that I really have time to make here tonight is, do you notice that there is an identity between the city and the people living in it? It's almost as if they're spoken of as the same idea. There's such a close identity between the two. But more maybe to the point here is, you notice that he says, "Come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife." The only thing I really want to say, and we'll see it reinforced in a few moments when we look at the 12 gates and the 12 foundations, is now you find a merging of what appears to be New Testament and Old Testament terminology for God's people, because, like in the Old Testament, right, Israel was referred to as the wife of Jehovah. And in the New Testament, the church is referred to not so much as the wife, but the bride of Christ. But now it says, there's an identification of those things. He says, "Come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife." They are the same. I would only say that there is a unity. There is a unity that is worked out between the people of God of both testaments in eternity. And I would not go so far as perhaps some very strong dispensationalist is to suggest that only the church occupies the New Jerusalem. That kind of a thought really bothers me when somebody is suggesting that I might be there and Abraham wouldn't. That to me is kind of goofy. But at any rate, we'll move from that. How about external appearance? Well, look at 11 through 14. It says, "Having the glory of God, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone." Here's something interesting. Then it says clear as crystal. Jasper is perhaps several colors, most normally red, not clear. We'll come back to that in a moment. Had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates. And at the 12 gates were 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now the glory of God. The glory of God. Ravi Zacharias made an interesting observation. I quote you two sentences or three from something he said on one occasion. He said, "The pursuit of the Hebrews was idealized and symbolized by light." And he quotes some scriptures, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. The people that sat in darkness have seen a great light. This is the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world." And now, when we have this portrayal of the glory of God, it's depicted in terms of light. But not just any light. Beautiful light, coruscating through these glass colors and these jewels that are mentioned. And so, once again, having the glory of God, it says, light like unto a stone most precious, her light like unto a stone most precious, even like jasper stone, clear as crystal. Well, in a while we're told about gold that's clear. What's that mean? Well, I think it's gold, but it's just not, when you see it, you get the impression of gold, but you can see through it, so something is different. And I think something's different here, too, because, like I said, the jasper is typically red in color, but here he says it's clear as crystal. which has led some people to think that what's really going on here is that you have a diamond of the highest order. And if that's true, or even the idea of crystal, you think about what light is like when it passes through that. What effect do you get? It's a staggering effect. Light that coruscates through these prisms and in the cuts and facets of a diamond, so that what you see is just a brilliant expression of beauty. Can you just begin even to have some small idea of what this is telling us about the glory of God? Of course, it says then, too, here's another detail, a wall great and high. Later we're told the dimensions of the wall. We'll save that. But I think there's symbolism in the wall, right? Walls, some people say walls make good neighbors. But walls typically are there to prevent access of what is undesirable, to protect you from harm, or to keep out those things that are perceived to be negative. Well, what are we told in verse 8? We're told that the fearful and unbelieving, all those things are excluded. And so, if at the very least, the wall is meant for us to understand that nothing is getting in there. There's nothing there that defiles. There's nothing there that is negative or reminds of the fall in any way. Then you have 12 gates, which are named for the 12 tribes of Israel, and 12 foundations named for the 12 apostles. And as I said earlier, the saints of all the ages are now brought together in complete unity. And there is something in the Bible about that. There's a big discussion, in fact. We won't take time for a part of it. A huge discussion of this from a doctrinal perspective in Ephesians chapter 2. But when you get to the end of it, here's what it says, verse 19. Now therefore, speaking to Gentile people, now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. So, one unified people, one temple, not that middle wall of partition, remember, that it talks about earlier in the chapter, not that antagonism that existed, particularly in the days of the Bible, between Jews and Gentiles, gone. And of course, we still don't have totally done away with this, right? Even in, no, so much Jews, not thinking so much Jews versus Gentiles, but just even us, we haven't quite licked that yet, have we? Because sometimes we have little perceived differences and these types of things. It's all going to be gone. There's going to be a perfect unity and a perfect fellowship. Next, we'll look at dimensions. I said we'd get back to saying something about this. Verse 15 tells us more than the walls. 16, 17, he talked with me. He that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city. There was a reed that was used in Ezekiel 2. And the gates thereof and the wall thereof, and the city lieth foursquare. The length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. The length and breadth and height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. Well, there are several things here that are interesting. First of all, what shape do you believe the New Jerusalem is? Cube. Good conclusion. I mean, it's probably, I think, the strongest one, but is there anything that prohibits it from being a pyramid? Not that I can see, because it says, verse 16, the city lieth foursquare, and the length is as large as the breadth. It doesn't say the width. It doesn't say the other dimension, the height. So it just says, then when he measured the city with the reed, then it mentions all three, the length and breadth and height of it are equal. One of those is left out when it says it lieth foursquare. So we know the bottom is a square, but engineers get fascinated with this kind of thing, and I mean, it is fascinating, but I tell you the truth, I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. I'll be just glad to be there, and I know it's going to be spectacular, but it, you know, these points are kind of interesting at times to ponder, and there's some really really interesting discussions that go on. People really get carried away with, you know, the pyramids in Egypt and all this kind of stuff. I think if I were forced, and there's nothing forcing me to, but 1 Kings 6:20 is a verse that might factor into the discussion. If the New Jerusalem is patterned after what was done in the Old Testament, then I would say your strongest conclusion is a cube. And I'll read you this verse. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 20 tells us about what Solomon built and what God prescribed there. And let me get here. 1 Kings 6:20 says this, and the oracle in the forepart was 20 cubits in length and 20 cubits in breadth and 20 cubits in the height thereof, and he overlaid it with pure gold and so covered the altar, which was of cedar. The whole temple was 40, so you had 20 and 20, but what was there was divided into two parts, and this, if you take them apart, if you consider them separately, it's cubical. All right, now what? So much for that. I don't worry about solving it. But what do you think about this? 12,000 furlongs, it says, is the length, height, and depth of this city. So we can actually translate that into terms we're familiar with. And when we do that, you'd be looking at about 1,380 miles. 1,380 miles by three dimensions, if you have a cube. If you believe this is a cube, I wonder how much interior space that is. A lot. I'm just looking here. 2.628 billion cubic feet. Miles. Boy, wouldn't you like to have the budget to go decorate that? This is going to give you unlimited budget. Go to Altoona or whatever. Go to the Height, or one of these light stores and just get all the most expensive fixtures you want. All the countertops, the most expensive ones you want. Just, can you ladies just imagine this? But it says, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will go again, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. So, if God, Abraham looked for a city, doesn't the Bible tell us this, whose builder and maker is God? So if this is something that God comes up with, I don't know that we can really wrap our minds around it tonight, but we can try. The walls are only 200 feet high, so when you consider a dimension of 1,380, or roughly 1,400 miles, by 1,400 miles, by 1,400 miles, what are you doing with the 200-foot wall? Not much. Which is one reason I think it's probably symbolic. But again, here's an interesting thing. Nothing tells us whether the 200 feet, the 144 cubits, nothing tells us whether that's the thickness or the height. Technically, it doesn't say that. Our assumption is it's a reference to the height. And I'm not trying to tell you it's not, but I'm just saying that's our assumption. But technically, I can't see that there's anything that really says. Only thing that we really have an interesting statement, it says that the wall, the first time we're told about it in verse 20 is the wall is great and high. Well, that's interesting because this dimension by comparison to the other doesn't seem like it qualifies as high, but that thickness is an interesting thought. I don't have the answer for you, but it's just interesting stuff to throw out there and think about. What's this thing made of? Chapter 21, verse 18 through 21. It says, and the building of the wall of it was of jasper. That color comes up again. It's also mentioned, or that material, in chapter 4, verse 3 as one of the predominant colors that emanates from God on the throne. And earlier we're told instead it's clear, it's like crystal. Now we're told about the gold. So the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. Well, that's not like any gold you and I know. We have white gold, they say. It's like you have white chocolate, too, right? I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but anyway, all that's translucent. The building, or opaque at best, but it says, the building of the wall of it was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. Foundations of the wall were garnished. That means adorned. It doesn't mean they were made out of these things, although we're told the gates are pearls. But here it just says garnished with all manner of precious stones. And it names them off, the foundations, what they're garnished with. Jasper, see that, verse 19, and then following. I'm just going to give you an idea of what these colors are so you can get some idea that if this light also reflects through all of that, or light reflects off of that, what an amazing, dazzling thing. The wall being of jasper, and I mentioned already, that's usually a red color, except earlier it's described as clear as crystal, if we're talking about the same thing there. Then the city is of pure gold, like unto glass, clear glass. That's not like any gold we know. The first foundation is jasper. The second is sapphire. That's a deep blue. The third is chalcedony. That's a pale blue. The fourth is emerald, which is green. The fifth is sardonyx, which is red and white. The sixth is sardius, which is red. The seventh, chrysolite, which is a gold or pale green. The eighth, beryl, which is aquamarine. The ninth, topaz, is golden. The tenth, chrysoprasus, is yellow-green. The 11th, jacinth, is violet. And the 12th, amethyst, is purple. Gates are pearls. And the street is pure gold, as transparent as glass. Some of the internal features in verses 22 through 22:5, and I'm just going to quickly rattle this off. Here, it's a lot of it is what's excluded. And what's excluded is there's no temple, there's no night, there's no defilement. But what's included, beginning in chapter 22, verse 1, are the following: the water of life, the tree of life, and God and His people in perfect harmony. So what are the four answers to the question, what will it be like in eternity? And quickly, here those thoughts are. Here's our significance. Number one, unblemished surroundings. Chapter 22, verse 3 says, there shall be no more curse. Gone is the curse. And everything that it entailed, no more tears, we're told earlier in chapter 21, verse 4. No death, no sorrow, no pain, and no more defilement. It's all gone. The former things are passed away. Pause for a moment. Randy Alcorn told an interesting story about a teenager. This is kind of maybe a typical teenager story, and no insult to teens mentioned, but teens can identify with this, and so can parents who have passed through those years with them. But the teen and her mother, the teen was embarrassed because the mother had just terribly disfigured arms. And so one day the mother took the girl shopping with her. She reached out to take something from the clerk, and the clerk was just aghast, horrified at what he saw. The girl was embarrassed and didn't want to be seen with her mother. Well, that, of course, hurt the mother. And so for the first time, the mother told her daughter what had really happened. This is what she said: when you were a baby, I woke up to a burning house. Your room was an inferno. Flames were everywhere. I could have gotten out the front door, but I decided I'd rather die with you than leave you to die alone. I ran through the fire and wrapped my arms around you. Then I went back through the flames, my arms on fire. When I got outside on the lawn, the pain was agonizing, but when I looked at you, all I could do was rejoice that the flames hadn't touched you. And of course, the girl stunned. She looked at her mother, and crying in shame and in gratitude, she kissed her mom's marred hands and arms. She knew, folks, none of that, nothing that mars, nothing that blemishes will be in that place. Unblemished surroundings. It is the complete and utter triumph of the story of redemption. Any place that sin has gone, any effect that sin has had, has been nullified, negated. It's gone because of the cross work of the Lord Jesus. Number two, unmistakable continuity. What in the world do I mean by that? Sounds like a mouthful, doesn't it? But look at 24 and 26 of chapter 21. The nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honor into it. Verse 26, and they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. but it said nothing that defiles. That's right. Is everything here defiled? Well, in the absolute sense, we realize that we live in a fallen world, but does that mean that everything that man, even fallen man, has done, or let me put it to you this way, been enabled to do by common grace, by the grace of God, is bad? I don't think so. That's not what this seems to indicate. What about all the brilliant music? What about some of those brilliant pieces of Bach? What about pieces that we know like Handel's Messiah? What about brilliant works of art, literature, things that truly are accomplishments only possible because of what God gave man? Now, some of them are in ways flawed, but others are not necessarily so. And we're told here the kings come and bring the honor and glory of the nations into it. So when you ask what will it be like in eternity, I can't explain to you everything this means except to say there'll be a continuity between the two things. It's not like all of a sudden you're going to be beamed into some dimension and it's going to just be like, where is this place? And then it gets into two. People ask, will I know my loved ones in eternity? Yes, you'll know your loved ones in eternity. Because now we see through a glass darkly, right? But then face to face. Now we know in part, but then we shall know even as also we are known. And did you notice in the story of the Transfiguration when they were there, the two disciples were there with Jesus, or the three, Peter, James, and John, and then Moses and Elijah, we're told, appeared with Jesus in glory. Did you notice that Peter didn't have to ask the Lord, who are these guys? He just intuitively knew. And when you get to heaven, you'll just know. You won't have to go around looking for Paul, because you'll know him when you see him. You don't have to go around looking for Abraham. You'll know him when you see him, and you'll sure know Jesus when you see him. And what about all of you, if you think about this, what about unborn babies? What about people here who have lost children? You ever think about that? To see them in eternity and to see them in maturity, to see them as if they were fully matured but younger adults, like Jesus. That's what we're told we're going to be like Jesus. See, he was 30, 33 maybe. People who are at the peak and prime of life, can you imagine seeing people like that but knowing immediately who they are? Because you're not going to see grandma like she was the last time you saw her. You're going to see grandma like her prime. So think about that, and you'll know her too. Or what about all those people that, if you ever studied genealogy, you know, if you go out there and talk to Polly Whelan, she's spent years and years doing that. And who knows how many of those people are Christians and aren't, but can you imagine getting up there to heaven and seeing all those people who are Christians and knowing who they are? I just think it's crazy. It's staggering. Absolutely staggering. So it'll be an unmistakable continuity. Then unfettered access to God. Chapter 22, verse 3 and 4. Look there quickly, and there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads. In the Sermon on the Mount, one of the Beatitudes, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And I quoted a while ago, now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face with Christ my Savior, face to face, what will it be? And all we've ever really known, in a lot of ways, is restricted access. In the Old Testament, that's exactly what was built into the whole equation. It was a lesson that was meant to be taught by the fact that you had the tabernacle and what surrounded it. A tall thing that, I mean, it was meant to give the impression you could not scale it, and it was white, which depicted God's righteousness. And so you could not get in except it were by the gate, and of course there's obvious symbolism in that. But then immediately the very first thing you came to was the brazen altar. And all throughout, then in the tabernacle structure, in the temple structure, what was it like? There was the Holy of Holies. Even the high priest could only go in there once a year, and that he couldn't do that without blood. Right? So all of that was meant to give us that idea that we are sinful, God is holy, and there's a barrier there created by our sin. Then, of course, God became man. And Jesus tabernacled with human flesh, and he came into this world and lived a holy and sinless life, giving hope, giving meaning to the idea that one day God would make his tabernacle. That's what it says. He became flesh. He tabernacled and dwelt. He tabernacled amongst us. It picks up that same symbolism from the Old Testament, the tabernacle, God with his people. Now the fruition, the complete fruition of it is there. And you've probably had this experience more than you know, and maybe it's frustrated you a time or two, but we live in a world of restricted access. I'm sure you realize this. That there's places you can't go, right? Because you don't have the right to go there. And in the security world, that's all the time, right? You don't have the security clearance to go there. You don't have the security clearance to know that unless you have your own private server. Oh, excuse me. But have you ever had that happen and parents have parental controls. So, you know, kids are surfing around and all of a sudden, boom, they can't go there. But did you ever have that happen, really and truly have that happen to you? I've had that happen a few times to me and it always irritates me. You are not authorized to view this page. And it wasn't because I was looking for something naughty. I get this message. You are not authorized to view this page. And I'm thinking, well, la-di-da. Probably just because I haven't paid something or, you know, don't have a subscription. You are not authorized to view this page. And invariably, it's something I'm hunting for a sermon. Oh, that really irritates me when that happens. Usually I find ways to work around them, but I can't say that I've ever hacked anything. But we live in a world of restricted access, but there is no restricted access. And finally, the last thing is unhindered service. This is what I was referring to earlier, that our, you know, our earthbound concepts, we think about what are we going to do in eternity and, you know, sit on a white cloud, like the advertisement for the one product. Verse 23 says, there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. And look at this, his servants shall serve him. What do you think about that? So you're wondering what you're going to do in eternity. So here's what I have to say to you about that. Did you ever really kind of get frustrated, whether it's with serving God or just in what you do in life, with the fact that you have so many physical limitations? And just things you can't do. Can't pick that up. It's too heavy. Can't keep working. Too tired. Can't keep going. Too thirsty. Strength gave out. Been out in the sun too long. Physical limitations. Life is filled with that because we live in a fallen world. Here's a quick story for you to consider. I find some inspiration in this. There's tons of stories like this, but this one is of a young man whose name was Jason McElwain. And he didn't even talk until he was 5 years old. Maybe this will give some encouragement to some parents that, you know, sometimes all kids are not alike, and I often say they don't all bloom the same time, but this boy clearly was different. He was diagnosed as having what they called high-functioning autism. But his passion and his hobby had been basketball. Well, no one deemed him good enough to play basketball, and he was too small anyway for the high school team when he got old enough for the high school team. So he started working as a team manager instead. And that job satisfied him, and he was good at it, but his dream was always to play. Imagine this. I mean, there's a lot of people like this. Dream and aspire to do things, but there's physical limitations that stand in the way. Well, it was the very last home game, and the coach just decided, well, I'll let him dress out, you know, not just the what he would wear for the team manager, but let him suit up just like one of the members of the team. And it got towards the end of the game. There was only 4 minutes left to play, and the coach decided he surprised everybody by calling him onto the court to let him play the last 4 minutes of the game. His first two shots missed. His third shot, he threw a three-pointer at 20 feet. That was just the beginning. In the next several minutes before the game was over, he threw five more of those. And at the buzzer, all of his teammates ran out onto the court, or that were there, and the others ran out onto the court, took him on their shoulders, the whole audience stunned by the thing that the kid had gone from, you know, just no one really knew, to a hero, a sports celebrity in 4 minutes' time. His story made the news, and he also received in 2006 the ESPY Award for Best Moment of Sports. But see, the folks, there are stories like that, all kinds of stories. As I said a while ago, tons of stories of people who have fought to overcome obstacles. But my point is, there are none there. You don't have to fight to overcome them. Whatever job it is that God has given you to do, whatever thing that He's placed you to do, you just do that and you never get tired, you never get weary. And not only that, you don't get tired of doing what you're supposed to be doing. Wait, ever think about that? You don't have any dreary days when you just think to yourself, you know, it happens even in the ministry, I can't wait to go home. You don't have any days like that. You just have days that there's none of that. And it's just hard to wrap your mind around what that's going to be. I only want to say in closing that all of these joys, the four things that I've mentioned, unblemished surroundings, unmistakable continuity, unfettered access to God, unrestricted access to God, unhindered service, they only accrue to the saved. It's clear. He makes it clear. But without, verse 8 of 21, the fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, all those folks, and at the end, the second death, he says, they have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. Did you notice, and I'll say this in closing, the Bible never offers any alternatives. There's not all this stuff about, well, maybe there's a second chance or maybe there's a purgatory. No, the Bible never offers that. We either know the Lord and these blessings that we're talking about here and the glories and joys of eternity belong to us because of Jesus, because we know Him, or there is only one alternative.